This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi everyone, thank you so much for being here and joining us for the screening and Q&A. My name is Heidi Amin Hong, and I have the honor to be here with Jess X. Snow, the filmmaker whose work you saw today. And I wanted to mention for any of you who were not here for Jess's wonderful introduction that they are also a multimedia artist and muralist, a poet, and generally a very accomplished person who's also a community organizer. Their works, as you saw, explore themes like migration, intergenerational care and healing, intimacies with the environment, and racial and climate justice, all from a queer Asian immigrant lens. And I have known Jess for a very long time, and as someone who is also a queer Chinese American immigrant woman, I see myself so much in Jess's works, and I appreciate their films and from that lens as well. And I'm very excited to continue our ongoing conversation across many years about Asian American healing in times of crisis and how art can help us heal, abolitionist responses to anti-Asian violence, as well as how Asian Americans can refuse the model minority and be in solidarity with Black, Indigenous, Palestinian, and other communities who are fighting against settler colonialism and other forms of violence. So I just wanted to open up the conversation and ask you, Jess, to perhaps talk a bit more about your journey as a filmmaker, especially as someone who has this multidisciplinary practice, who was a poet and a visual artist in addition to your filmmaking practice. What are your sources of inspiration and how did you come to film?
Thank you for the question. So I came to film I first started as a poet and a visual artist, and when I was very young, like I had a lot of social anxiety and I had a stutter when I was like in high school, and sometimes I still have it. So it kind of gave me a lot of like stage fright, and I felt like film was something that would really pushed me out of my comfort zone, and especially acting in a film. Like when I was younger, as like a student, I never thought I would ever see myself on the screen and like act in my own work. So, so I think it's a way for me to kind of like take back this like stereotype of like Asian Americans being like silent and being seen as like obedient all the time. And I felt like I wanted to make films about like the bad Asians, or like and allow us to kind of emote and fail and be seen in our folk complexity. And I felt like film is like the closest medium to experiencing the way that someone dreams or someone or someone remembers. It's honest. It's like giving a memory to someone else, and I feel like each of these films is a reflection of who I was in the times that I made it, and it's like a time capsule of each period of my life. Like, yeah,
I love that idea of film being the only medium that captures how we dream and perhaps the visions that we have for another world. And I did want to touch on the way you use music in your films. The music, particularly, I think in all of the films, but particularly in Little Sky, becomes so haunting and a reflection of the character's journey, but also a way for the community to come together and see each other through performance. And of course, the song that Sky sings to their father or to her father is kind of a famous Chinese song that mm-hmm. I recognized from my childhood. And I think music in general is such a powerful way to capture a memory. So I would love to hear you talk more about how you use music in your films and how music becomes a way for communal healing as well.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think music, like I always want to live vicariously through the characters, and there was a part of me that always wanted to be a pop star, but I'm like, I just don't feel like I have the bravery or just like the ability to make music in those ways. So I basically wrote a lot of the songs, the lyrics of the songs as poetry, mm-hmm. and then I worked with my friends as who are musicians to write original songs for Little Sky, and I wanted to create songs that reflect queer Asian chosen family and the longing for community. And then the Chinese song that was sung in the film is actually a song that my parents and I used to sing when they were together, and it's like a song for me that symbolizes like the joy of like childhood and like the innocence of childhood before we come of age and like grow up and have to deal with all the hardships of life. So it was really important for me to have that song be in the film and to have such a tender, loving song be the song that Sky uses to get their father to remember who they are, and it's almost like used in this way that's like the last words that they will say to their dad before they walk away to kind of pack an emotional mm-hmm. punch, and I thought it was really interesting to use a song in that way that could it's almost like Sky is asking their dad to love them, and using a song to do that I thought was mm-hmm. really powerful. So and I think music just has been always an important part of my art practice, and I always like get lost in song. So
and I think the fact that your films harness these communities to come together to make music together is so powerful. And you can really see that labor of love in the songs that are played. And on that note, I wanted to hear more about why community and chosen family are important for your filmmaking practice. In what ways do these communities that the films represent actually reflect the communal process of filmmaking as an art form that is inherently about being with others and communing with others as well?
I think community is really important to me, as well as chosen family, because I feel like my own blood family, they don't fully understand what I do, but they are like ultimately supportive of me like being an artist as long as I'm able to make a practical living for myself. But I don't think my parents understand the political nature of my work, and if they do, they're trying to get me to like make art that is more mainstream and more like accessible. So I think I've had to build a strong like community of people who do understand the way I see the world, and they have like become my family and have fulfilled kind of like the needs for emotional being seen emotionally that I don't think I get from my blood family. And I think on film sets, because it's so collaborative, when the filmmaking process is going well and when all the actors is on the same page and like the set is running well, it really feels like magic. Like it feels like you're bringing your friends together to experience, mm-hmm. to bear witness to like the life that's happening in front of you, like with the actors, and also like being an actor for the first time in that film. Like I felt like acting was like a way to be as present as possible in a world that makes it so hard for us to be present and makes it easier for us to disassociate. Like I felt like the most present that I felt when making any type of art when I was acting in that film. But I will also say it's not always the case. Like sometimes film sets are really hard. Sometimes there's conflict, mm-hmm. and people don't get along, and actors get upset, and it's all like a process to learn how to work collaboratively. And also, I think a big thing that I'm unlearning is that as a director of films, like we don't have to, it's not our jobs to be responsible so that everyone has a good time all the time. We have to trust our producers and the other people we've chosen to bring on to the film and the assistant director to take care of that. And every time a set does not go well, that gives us a lot of wisdom about how to build a more community-oriented set, mm-hmm. in the future. And I think my mistakes have taught me like a lot more than like the like successful community-oriented sets have. So
yeah, thank you for being so thoughtful about the process of filmmaking. I wanted to return to something you said earlier about making films for the bad Asians, mm-hmm. to counter the model minority myth and to refuse the model minority as a narrative. And for those of you in the audience who might not be familiar with this term, the model minority as a narrative that was proliferated, especially in the 60s and 70s, to characterize Asian Americans as smart, hardworking, good at math, primarily to pit Asian Americans against other people of color, Black and Latinx folks who were organizing along with Asian Americans in the civil rights movement. And I'm not so interested in proving that the model minority myth is false, because in a way we already know that, but I'm drawing here from the work of Professor Aaron Ning, who is here, who asks us to think about what does it mean when our communities are the ones enforcing the model minority myth, and what kind of psychic cost does that require of Asian American students and young adults who have to bear the burdens of it. So I would love to hear Jess talk more about how your films are also a way to refuse the model minority myth and are a political statement against this idea of Asian Americans as good citizens, per se.
Yeah, thank you for this question. I think it's a very central question in the stories that I tell. And I also wanted to say that students here are really, really lucky to have an Asian American Studies department. Like I didn't even know what model minority was, or didn't have the language to even name some of the unwellness and some of the struggles I was going through until much later, and I had to find out, learn Asian American studies just like from my friends who were just in that field who weren't my classmates. So I think it's really great that you have professors like Aaron and Diane here, and you can take these classes. And but I think that for me, I think in mainstream Asian American films, like especially in like some of the more recent films, like Past Lives, for example, like the characters are really trying to make the American dream, and like kind of get to these get like approval from these art institutions or these notions of success that is kind of what America defines as what success is. And I think for young people growing up with these kind of impossible standards, it's very bad for our mental health. And I think in my films, I just want to give voice to like the voices in our head that like wants to rest and wants to dream and sometimes the parts of us that have to fail and to just remind us that it's okay if we fail and failure is a part of life and it's how we grow and it's in these moments of failure and it's in our breakdowns that we discover where our authentic self is, because I felt like I had to perform a version of myself all the time, whether it's for my parents, for professors, or for like the film industry. And I just think that it would be so sad to live our entire lives when 90% of our time is spent performing and 10% is spent living our real lives. So I wanted to make films that give us space to recover our authentic selves, and I hope you can find some of that in my work, like in The Dragons and in The Teleportation.
Yeah, I think that statement about failing is so powerful, because in some ways failing is when we find ourselves and it signals a new beginning, and that's so evident in your films. And I wanted to linger on this topic of refusal, especially in the context of this last film, which is a response that is shaped by the rise of anti-Asian violence in New York City, at the height of the pandemic. And this is a moment where your film really refuses carceral responses to anti-Asian violence and instead turns to modes of community healing and communities coming together to respond and protect vulnerable Asian American families and in the mother and daughter in the film. And also, I wanted to plug a recent special issue that just came out, edited by Rachel Kuo and Diane Wong, who are founding members of the Asian American Feminist Collective. And their work is really trying to craft an Asian American abolitionist feminism that thinks through responses to anti-Asian violence that don't turn toward expanding police presence and expanding the carceral state, and instead are lingering on more broadly, to think more broadly about violence that's structural, and also are more creative in terms of how we respond to violence and how we heal as communities. So what does abolition look like to you in the film, and why is community care so important? Why is it powerful to imagine moments of community solidarity? And you can perhaps talk more about your mural that you feature in the film as well.
Yeah, thank you for this question. I think this is something that I'm still like discovering what abolition means to me, but Ruth Wilson Gilmore, this Black prison abolitionist and scholar, like talks about how abolition and freedom, we can make it out of what we have, and abolition is a practice or life in rehearsal, and it's like a verb. It's not like a destination that will one day happen where we're going to live in a world where we no longer need police, but it's creating the conditions for a world like that to exist in our practices, the way that we move through conflict, the way that we the way that we treat each other in the smallest person-to-person relationships. And then once we're able to like move through conflict without throwing people away, then we could ultimately as a society learn how to address the big systemic violences. And I think because a lot of anti-Haitian violence, it occurs with other communities of color as the perpetrators. I think like responding with police is only gonna like create more like anti-black police brutality, and is gonna pit the Asian and Black and Latinx communities against each other more. And I don't think it addresses the root of the violence. And I think if we have more examples of what community care looks like, and what solidarity looks like, and we normalize what it means to have the really, really hard and sometimes ugly and messy conversations with each other, I think that's how we can begin to create a more abolitionist world. And I think in Roots That Reach Toward the Sky, even though it's not explicitly talking about like not having a carceral response or being like anti-police, the way that we see Kai and Zia move through the store being attacked is through like the response of creating a community mural or like getting the community together to repair the window through mutual aid, and even the immigrant mom kind of like acknowledging that the inevitability of violence, whether it's violence that she has to experience at home in China or through the immigration process, like it's not gonna, I think just seeing all of these characters move through the crisis without calling the police and finding other alternative modes of moving through it, whether it's acupuncture, I think is just the beginning of that conversation. But I don't think this film is able to answer all of it together. But maybe it starts the conversation.
Yeah, I so appreciate thinking about these films as a beginning, whether that's starting a conversation or healing intergenerational trauma and healing the self. And even though some of these films are about violence, they are ultimately about these desires for connection and queer intimacy. I'm especially struck by how Safe Among Stars is cultivating these different spaces of queer intimacy and desire as the main character heals from this act of sexual violence. Could you speak more about how intimacy and care of the self, but also of other human and non-human communities, like how plants feature prominently in After Earth and even Safe Among Stars, how do these moments of intimacy figure into your filmmaking?
So I think just like going back to the idea of like the bad Asian, I feel like we don't really see enough like queer Asians or like Asian women in with the erotic but in a way that has like their agency and is also like in acts of queer intimacy. So I really wanted to explore that in Safe Among Stars, and I also think the intimacy with plants and intimacy with the sky and the stars, like it all feels like a space of solace and safety when when we are like, when there is this enormous pressure around us to fulfill like the American dream or to fulfill all the wishes of our immigrant parents, and it just feels like such an impossible thing to fulfill. So I think the plants and the herbs, the sky and the birds are like all feel like places of dreaming and possibility that can hold us when the state and the model minority is unable to hold us. So, yeah,
that's beautiful. And After Earth is a film that I think of often and that I teach often in my classes on Asian American migration. And it's such a beautiful starting point for thinking about Asian American solidarities with indigenous communities and what it means to be a person of color living on occupied land, on occupied indigenous land. And Roots That Reach Toward the Sky also has this allusion to Chamorro decolonization, where the Chamorro partner is involved as an organizer. And I was wondering if you could talk more about what it means for these films to think about affinities across Asian diasporic and indigenous communities, and how Asian American communities can critically re-examine our relationships to the environment and to land.
Yeah, so I think there's the Asian and indigenous solidarity and intimacies is definitely something that I've been exploring for a while in my work, like both in After Earth and in Roots That Reach Toward the Sky. But I feel like I want to explore that solidarity in like a deeper and more nuanced way. And I think because like there's a lot of like tension between like Zia, the Chamorro partner, and Kai, who's the East Asian partner, and I think that's partially because Pacific Islander people and like East Asians, like there's just a lot of tensions between how they experience their Asian just like their different racialized experiences. And I think for Zia in the film, like she's able to like access her like anger and rage much more easily, while like Kai is much more okay with just like staying quiet and like shutting down the store and stuff. And I wanted that tension to be like a central part of the film. But I think that the more that I'm learning in my experience about what it means to build coalitions and solidarity, like I think I think a lot about about something that Native Hawaiian scholar Jamaica Osorio says about the Native Hawaiian concept of Aloha Aina, which is love for the land. And she talks about how in order to love another person, your love has to go through the land in order to reach another person. So, and then like for like indigenous, I think how that relates to Asian and indigenous solidarity is that like when we live on lands that we are not from, and it's lands that are indigenous to Turtle Island, by learning, by opening ourselves up to the vulnerability of what it means to admit that we are inherently not in right relationship with the land, and that's a relationship that we have to learn, and the vulnerability that it requires to learn, and admitting that we are wrong and being okay with the wrongness and being open to being a witness and learning about how to be in right relationship with the land is actually helps us learn how to love other people better, whether they are an indigenous person or whether they are just like any human being. And I think that's something that I've been sitting with. And if I were to make like a longer film, like a feature, I would love to like explore that more in depth, because I think as a community, we're so afraid of saying the wrong thing or not knowing how to. We have so much guilt about being on stolen land that a lot of times people are afraid to build these coalitions and solidarities and friendships and have the hard conversations. So I hope to make films that can inspire people the bravery to have these conversations and not to just like cower in fear of messing up, if that makes any sense. So yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I so appreciate how the films don't shy away from the tensions and the difficult conversations and the contradictions in terms of, for example, in After Earth, Kit Yan's mother being so intimately connected to the plants that remind her of China and her home while cultivating them on Hawaiian land. Yeah. But you mentioned ideas for your next feature, and I would actually love to hear you talk about what you're envisioning next as your feature film and any ideas that you would like to share at this stage.
Yeah, so I think this conversation actually inspires me to like lean more into the contradictions and the hard conversations, because I'm glad that you think that these films aren't shying away from them, but I would like for them to like be like braver and like kind of go deeper into the hard conversations, and because I just feel like that's not something that we ever see on screen. Like that's those hard conversations are things that I see my friends go through, and like organizers go through those conversations all the time. Like our movement elders have gone through those hard conversations, but I would love to like bring them to the screen, and like, and I guess an example of a feature film that I'm developing is about, I'm co-writing it with my friend Alan Pelez Lopez, who's a Afro-Indigenous poet and scholar, and it's about an undocumented Chinese immigrant server and a Afro-Indigenous kitchen worker at a restaurant in San Francisco, and their friendships get their lives get like tied together because they both discover they have time traveling abilities that they can't control. So when the Chinese when the Afro-Indigenous character disappears because they get stuck in the 18th century, the Chinese American character has to like confront her fear and like travel back in time to like retrieve her. So it's about like two people who make mistakes and like they're kind of like anti-Black and anti-Asian against each other in the beginning, and they pit themselves against each other, but then through this journey of time travel of seeing what their like ancestors had to go through during Chinese exclusion and post like slavery emancipation, they begin to understand how their struggles are connected, and then they form a friendship that changes their lives. So I'm really interested in, that's an example of a film that I'm trying to make that explores those things. So yeah.
That film sounds incredible, and I'm sure all of us in the audience would love to see it.
And also I'm turning, I want to become the sky into a feature, and there's a part of me that wants to act in it as well. So yeah, because that one was the most fun I've ever had on set, being in that film. Yeah.
I have one last question before we move to the audience, but I was wondering if you could talk, since we're on this topic of time travel and futures, if you could talk more about why the speculative and why magical realism is so important in your work. What does it mean for art and film to imagine other futures for us?
I don't know. I guess the speculative is important because, like, fantasy and science fiction, it's always given us the language to talk about a future that our society right now can't imagine. And I find, like, the healing that I most need in stories that are speculative, because I write the futures that I kind of write the healing that I want to experience in my life into these these films. So it's like a way to feel like it's like the impossible is possible, and then the process of creating these films helps me actually believe that when I share them with the world. So yeah.
Thank you so much, Jess. We will now move to audience questions.
I just had a quick question. I noticed the repeating motif of, like you said, looking up at the sky and that connection there, as well as the, I don't know what to call them, like the black specks and like the movement with there, kind of like, I felt like these themes of like the collective almost, and I was just curious if you could kind of speak a little bit more to that and, you know, the symbolism or why you chose to continue that motif throughout your films.
Yeah. So the thanks for the question. The specks in the sky, they're starling murmurations, and I just think they're so magical, and they take different forms in the films, but they're, I think it shows like our like every time something like magical in a film happens, I have them, and they also like show me the power of the collective and community as well. But I don't have like a deeper explanation than that. But I just find it to be really beautiful, and like I hope to get to see a starling murmuration in person someday.
Okay, thank you very much for your work. I was interested in this last discussion about your interest in moving more into speculative fiction, science fiction, and magical realism kind of relates to that too in terms of fantasy. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about artists, filmmakers, but all kinds of artists who have done work with science fiction that might have inspired you, that you're thinking about when you're thinking about a move more explicitly into science fiction?
I'm not sure if I'm trying to move into science fiction, but definitely more like fantasy. And I feel like I don't have any references that I feel like, I feel like my references are corny a little bit, but I saw this film. I guess I see like all the big films. Like I've seen like Dune, and then I also saw this this film called Bones and All. It's like a Timothée Chalamet film, but it was takes place in this future, and it's like these cannibals on the run. And there are things that I liked about those films, but also I just feel like there's like so much more that could be explored in like science fiction and futuristic stories, and we never we rarely ever see like Asian American characters or like POC characters in those roles like with agency. So I think I get really inspired by some ideas of like blending different unexpected genres together, like this idea of like in Bones and All, it's like these like teenage vampires that are on the run and on the outskirts of society. Like I think I want to become the sky, and the feature version of it is kind of inspired by like a similar feeling of wanting these punk social outcast Asian American characters pushed to the outside of society because it's in a world where dragons are illegal. So I like taking these familiar ideas, but like taking my own spin on it, and drawing inspiration from like more like art house classic Asian cinema, like Edward Yang and like Wong Kar-wai, but then connecting that with like the more coming of age like first person POV that is in a lot of American indie films, and combining that with like sci-fi and science fiction and seeing what happens, I guess. But I would love to read more literature that is doing that. But I feel like oftentimes in fiction and poetry, it's oftentimes like ahead of film, and I wish there were just more films available.
So when you were talking, Jess, I was thinking about how that feature that you're talking about has some similarity to Octavia Butler's Kindred, because mm-hmm. the device that we would identify as science fiction, which is time travel, is a way of going back into history and excavating it with accuracy and fidelity in order to think really deeply about things like race and conflict and then reconciliation and love to bring it into a more speculative space. But the question I have is, can you talk just a little bit about how your poetry, because you're also a poet, relates to some of the work we've seen tonight in film?
Thank you so much for that question. Rick was my poetry professor in undergrad. We took many independent studies together, so shout out to Rick. And I've never thought about this question before, but I do feel like for me, each of these films, I think of each scene as like a poem. And I think my process as like a writer director is to find the poem in each scene, and through poetry I learned a lot about the economy of language and like trying to use like the fewest words to say something really nuanced and deep, and I think that helps me a lot in writing and directing, because it helps me like cut out all the dialogue that is unnecessary and sometimes in just like a look or like in the silence between characters. You can have like a whole world or like a whole story, or just like pairing visual like imagery together of like a landscape and like a flashback, and like song can be more effective than a character telling you what's happening to them. So poetry taught me to show rather than tell, and to kind of like get to the heart of like a moment. And I try to center that in my filmmaking process. So yeah.
Thank you all so much for coming and staying for the Q&A. Thank you, Jess, for this incredible conversation and your beautiful work. Your work really helps us envision a future where refuge for human and non-human communities do not depend on the displacement and dispossession of others. And they also really demonstrate the crucial role of art that is engaged with social movements and envisioning a future, opening up spaces for us to heal, gather, and imagine otherwise as a collective. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jess will be available after this in the lobby where there will be prints for sale. And I also wanted to mention that on Tuesday, Jess will be doing a banner making workshop with the Department of Asian American Studies for any students and community members who are interested. You can go on the Asian American Studies website directly and sign up there, as well as see the other amazing events that are happening this quarter. So thank you, everyone. We will see you outside in the lobby.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.